Yom Ha'atzmaut Sameach. Happy Independence Day, and welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm your host, Yaakov Katz. This week, Israel marks its 73rd Independence Day. That's 73 years of living as an independent, democratic, and Jewish state in the ancient land of Israel. Not a small feat. Every day has its reminders why. This week, mysterious explosions rocked Iran's main nuclear facility at Natanz, the place where the Islamic Republic enriches uranium. And the attack was immediately attributed to the Mossad, a sign of how this battle simply never ends. Attacks in Syria continue, sometimes in the Gaza Strip, and the IDF is gearing up this summer for one of the largest drills it has ever held. Politically, we continue to be stuck, and while Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to form a coalition, it's an uphill battle, getting the far-right members of the religious Zionist Party to agree to sit in a government supported by Arab MKs. As all of this is happening, Netanyahu's trial continues. The testimonies that come out of there daily could be an earth-shattering headline on its own, if there wasn't so much else going on. We'll speak later with our legal analyst, Yonah Bob, to hear more on what is happening inside the Jerusalem District Court. But first, we look back at the last 73 years and forward to the next with managing editor David Brin, Jerusalem Report editor Steve Lindy, our international edition editor Liat Collins, and Rosella Turkatin, who covers health and archaeology for the Jerusalem Post. Let's go. So, Liat, I'd like to start with you. You've been living in Israel now for 42 years, which is a long time. I think I've been here almost 27. When you look back at Israel in these last 42 years, the country's really changed, right? I mean, I remember coming to Israel, and they used to have that 1 week a year at the Supersol. The American week was like the 1 week you could get potato chips back in the 1990s, right? So, I mean, so much has changed. But when you think back on 42 years, what strikes you?
That we now have phones in our hands as opposed to actually having to look for phones with those tokens, the old Yisraelim. There's been a tremendous amount of change. It's in a way, it's become a very advanced, particularly advanced Western world, where when I first arrived, people didn't have phones, people didn't have cars, and electricity was very patchy. And now we have this tremendous growth. And I think a lot of things we now take for granted, I think on the way we're have lost a little bit of that solidarity that you had there.
The innocence.
Yes and no, because I now realize how close it was to just after the Yom Kippur War, and it was ahead of the first Lebanon War, which affected us all very badly. So it wasn't exactly a period of innocence. I think that people who came in the late 60s got that. But there was something about the togetherness, which I think just because of the physical conditions, the place was very small, the population was very small. Even the way that now, you know, you have these super commercialized events for Independence Day and the barbecues, whereas you used to have picnics on the curb and in the park because that's all you could get to. I think that's been one of the major changes.
Well, they probably didn't really even have barbecues back then the way they do now. So, Steve, you've been here 32 years, right, coming from South Africa back then. How has the country changed in your view, from your perspective?
Well, I think that the country's changed in amazing ways, in leaps and bounds, and it's almost unrecognizable from the country that I arrived in as a idealistic pioneer who wanted to join the army, go to kibbutz and do some farming. Now we've all become high tech and way ahead of most countries in the world in so many fields. And for me, I think Israel remains, was, and is, and will be the most interesting country in the world to live in. And I think so many fascinating things happen here every day, which is why I think we're all in news, because we like to report on them and be the first to report on them. But as Israel turns 73, there are signs, of course, that we're maturing in many ways.
Well, so we'll get to that. You're very optimistic, Steve. I appreciate that. We can always count on you for some optimism. And now I'm just going down the scale here of length of duration in Israel. We get to David. David Brin has been here 31 years, just 1 year short of Steve. So David, looking back, the country, how does it look?
One thing I want to say, the difference for living here as someone who made Aliyah back in the 80s, back then, things had changed so much. Back then, all you had was aerograms to communicate with people in the outside world, or very expensive long-distance phone calls that usually didn't work or crackled. And today, you know, the world is so much smaller. Now we have instantaneous communication with everyone through Zoom, through any means you can imagine. That's a huge change, as well as the... I remember when cable TV first came into Israel, like in 1990 or 91, we only had one channel before then, and all of a sudden now we had this plethora of channels, aside from Jordan TV, which had awful movies. So, I mean, it just opened the... I think we're much more worldly now than we were then. Back then it was like a small village, and now it's become a big city.
And last but not least, Rosella, right? So, Rosella, you've been here a grand total of 4 years, coming from Italy,
yes,
right? Can you put your finger on some big change that you've seen in those 4 years here?
Listen, I think that for the vast majority of these 4 years, Israel has not fought a war. When I came, it was not long after the last round of Gaza war. And I think that it was still very, very present. I had come actually a little before to study here for a period. Several children of my teachers had children serving in the army. People were still very traumatized. Recently we have entered a different kind of trauma with the coronavirus pandemic. But it strikes me as very interesting how we kind of like have forgotten what, at least in my experience, what it means to kind of like be on the verge of war, except every few months before the coronavirus, there has been a day that really seemed to bring us back then.
Right. Now, we might not be fighting an overt war, but Steve, there is a lot of mysterious explosions that are taking place in different, in particularly in Iran. Claims of responsibility by Israel, which is a dramatic change and shift from the way we used to do things, where we would stay quiet and we wouldn't speak openly. Is this the new Israel, the Israel that can't keep its mouth shut, the Israel that needs to run to the media to take responsibility? Is this connected at all to the political instability that we have? Is everything just lawless in some way?
Well, you know, there are parts of the new Israel that are disturbing, and this is one of them. I don't think we should be schwitzing, as they say in Yiddish, or boasting every time we carry out a successful attack against an enemy. I think the policy in the past made a lot of sense to be quiet and not to to overstate our power and our success when it happens. And I think it has gone a little bit to our heads, and we need to keep it in check. And perhaps, you know, as they say in the movie, the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know, if you want to talk, talk, and if you want to shoot, shoot.
Right. But when Teddy Roosevelt used to say, walk softly and carry a big stick.
Right. We seem to like to talk and shoot at the same time. but Liat, you know, I'm curious from your perspective, do you think is this Bibi, is this Netanyahu who's kind of changing the way we're doing things now?
I think the situation has changed a bit also. I think it is partly Netanyahu's personality to show off. And I think that is part of his personality. I think there's also a rationale from his point of view that this is deterrence, because if... We're doing obviously very complicated things. We're doing things that you know are written in scripts and in the TV series Tehran.
It could make a movie. For sure.
I mean, they did. I mean, Tehran, right. the TV series is almost like that. So, and I think this is also part of the deterrence to show. On the one hand, I mean, and it might be also what's led to the Abraham Accords. You know, this is we're showing peace partners that we are very active against Iran, which is a common enemy, and that we're active against enemies in general, full stop. And I think that this could be part of the move that pushed us towards the Abraham Accords. So I don't think it's all bad. I don't also like the showing off. It's not in... I was in the army in very, very different years. I was actually in the army during the strike on the Osirak
1981.
Reactor.
You didn't tell anybody.
I have to say that I remember the story. I don't know if maybe Steve, as a former radio person, remembers this, that the radio got the news about the strike and they didn't believe it. And in the end, they called Emanuel Halperin, who was nephew of Menachem Begin, and asked him to ask his uncle if it's actually true before they broadcast it, because they didn't believe it was true.
Nowadays, we blow something up and then we tweet about it right away, right? But David, you know, so you've been following Netanyahu's career for a long time also. Do you think that Israel has... We can't keep quiet anymore? Is it maybe the way the media operates today? Is it Israel being... confident or maybe overconfident?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely an over-transparency out there that nothing can be done now behind closed doors that doesn't get out and is leaked and tweeted and made into huge news. I think part of it is maybe our prime minister himself who's trying to make a case that only he can lead the country and protect it from calamity. But I think it's an overall... overall complexion of what's been happening.
Rosella, I want to move to you for a moment. You wrote a great piece for our Yom HaTzma'ut magazine, our special supplement marking Independence Day, about the role that Olim, new immigrants to Israel, have played on the front lines of the medical battle against COVID-19 over the last year, which has been a tough year. It's been a tough year for a lot of people, but it's also been a year that has met some success for Israel, right? So when you kind of look to the future of Israel's ongoing fight and campaign against COVID, what would your prediction be?
So I think that indeed Israel has showed many strength in this pandemic. First and foremost, it's incredible human fabric, because I think that I don't know, even just the amount of the level of empathy and the level of commitment that the a lot of people have shown, including the medical staff, including, for example, the fact that in Israel, you know, a few months into the pandemic, most, if not all, medical centers have allowed people to visit their coronavirus sick relatives and so on and so forth. In many countries, including in Italy, where I'm from, people die alone. A year into the pandemic, people continue to die alone. And one of the people I interviewed was actually a very young social worker, 26-year-old from America, who all of a sudden was hired to help patients deal with bureaucracy and disability rights. All of a sudden, there's not enough manpower. She's asked to serve a few hours in the corona ward, and she has to deal with family whose wives, whose husbands are dying of COVID and they cannot see them, and work with the health ministry to find a way to bring someone who is sick at home to visit their husband or their father on the deathbed in the hospital. And even with all of the bureaucracy that Israel has, even with all the problems and so on and so forth, they do find a solution.
Right.
So I think, looking ahead, I think Israel has to be able to transform the incredible amount of energy they put into the emergency in how to fix bigger problems.
Is that unique to Israel, Steve? Like that we do these things, we go the extra mile to make sure that a loved one can come say goodbye to their father, mother, whoever it might be, a spouse who's about to die from COVID, despite the risk. As Rosella said, no other hospital is doing it in the world. We were the first to do it.
I really do think there is something special about the way people treat one another in this country. I mean, we talk all the time about how divided we are and the political left and right and pro-BB and anti-BB camps. But actually, when it comes down to it, living here, you do feel what we call in Hebrew the ichpatiot, the fact that people really do seem to care. It's not going to be like New York where someone walks opposed to a homeless person dying in the street. This is a country in which we really do feel that, you know, everyone, kulam arivim ze leze, that we're all responsible for one another. And, you know, I think that it really does, you feel it when you're here. And yes, other countries have it, and I'm not saying we're any better, but it is very special to live in a place where people do care for one another.
Why is that, David? Why?
Well,
is it the Jewish? Is it a Jewish thing? Is it an Israeli thing?
I'm not sure. I was going to say maybe I think Israel has maybe lost some of its specialness. And I saw an interesting thread online the other day about how Israeli people are special and maybe much better than the people that govern it, and that there may be something to that. I think I agree with Steve that there's like something really amazing among the Israeli people, but as we seem to be mired in a political mess headed to a inevitable fifth election, it seems, and with our prime minister on trial for corruption, it seems like we've lost our way at the top, and I think maybe we have to build again from the ground up.
To me, it definitely feels that way at times also, without being overly pessimistic. But Liat, you have a different take.
I think there's two things at play here a bit. One, I remember a story from a few years ago, somebody who collapsed at the airport in Paris, and two people stopped to help, only two people in a very, very crowded airport. And those two people were both Israelis. One was Jewish and one was Arab, but they were both Israelis. I think one was a doctor and one was a nurse. And they stopped to help because that is kind of, it's part of our national DNA, that collectivity, and you can't sort of ignore that sort of thing. I think the other thing is that we do think out of the box, and we think, and that's obviously evident also in the military and in the technology film, and also in the nursing practice and in the hospital. I mean, I think other countries think very rigidly. They create a law. That's the law. That's the rule. That's what they're doing. That's what they're sticking. And in Israel, if they don't like the law, they'll find a way to change that or around it. And there's a lot more flexibility and less rigidity on those sort of things. And I think that comes through. And I what I've noticed, like over the last year through the corona pandemic, is a lot more talk of people, Israelis abroad, who are thinking of coming back home and who even have come back home. And the continuous arrival of new immigrants, despite the pandemic.
Right. I mean, on that note, I remember a conversation early on in the pandemic that I had with a family member where I mentioned kind of what you said and what Steve was saying, that if, God forbid, it reaches a point that, you know, people will be, and there were these reports coming out of China of people on a street corner begging for help. Where do you want to be? In New York, in Chicago, or in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv? Because you know that in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, no one, despite the risk, no one's going to let you just lie on a street corner. Rosella, as the newer immigrant to Israel, out of everyone here, how does it feel to you, like knowing Italian culture, which has been hit really hard, and you recently came back from there, from a visit to your parents, knowing how hard it's been for Italy compared to what we see here in Israel, how does that strike?
So I think that Israel has actually shown the ability of thinking out of the box and of being a little more pragmatic into like, let's find a solution and let's go for it, as opposed to what has happened in Italy, the European Union, for example, everyone's saying that they made terrible mistakes and now they don't have enough vaccines for people. But I think also again, in Italy, I really feel like I see a deep lack of empathy at many, many levels. Like people who are going through a hard time in being in lockdown almost continuously for over a year are treated as if they are anti-social, or that they are almost like spoiled people. And I think in Israel there has been a little more of an ability to understand different difficult situations. And also speaking to medical staff in Israel, I often speak about, you know, new cures, new research, what's their experience. I think I feel like that there's an empathy for people regardless of what COVID is. People who are suffering for financial point of view, from a family point of view, and so on and so forth.
I want us to kind of zoom out from the last year and take a look to the upcoming year, right, as we move towards our 74th anniversary. some predictions. So, David, let's start with you. Where how will Israel change a year from now? What will we see different? Bibi's trial will still be going on. He'll still be prime minister. I mean, are we still going to be so focused on him?
I think probably the biggest challenge we might have is to avoid what's happened in part in the United States the last few years, where the political break is so huge that members of the same family, you know, won't talk to each other because of one supporting Trump, one supporting Biden. I don't think we've gotten there yet, but I think it could happen, and that's something that we have to really work hard to avoid. I'm always reminded of the great author, Israeli author Edgar Keret, who's a secular Tel Aviv liberal person who has one sibling who's ultra-Orthodox, lives in Jerusalem, and one who's a settler who lives in the West Bank. And, you know, they have nothing in common aside from, you know, being siblings, but they all get together on holidays and they all have cordial relations, at least last I heard. And I think that's a great role model. And I think that's probably what's going to keep Israel going in the future is us to work out a way to overcome our differences and face the big picture together.
Can that happen?
I think it can. I think again, a lot of it, as you mentioned, focuses on a change of leadership. I think Netanyahu, for all the good he's done for the country, has turned into a detriment for good or ill. I mean, he's the one that I think is preventing governments from being formed, fifth election from coming up. And I think once we're over that hump and into a new era, that could change things.
Liat, a lot of people agree with David, right, that a change at the top would make a change also throughout the country. I'm a bit more skeptical that it's just on that, right? We the people should be able to make, I think that would have a big impact, but I also think that we have to want change. So when you look towards the year to come, how do you see Israel developing?
I don't think it depends on who's the prime minister. The people of the country are far greater than the person who's leading. And I think For example, I think there'll be a trend because of this government impasse. So there'll be more power at the municipal level, I think, and even the very local level, the local community centres and so on. I think it will, the mayors, this is their chance to step in. We've seen it a bit through Corona with them determining for themselves when schools will go back and so on and so forth. And I think this will, the more that the government itself is in an impasse, we'll see this filter down to a local level, and there'll be more initiatives by mayors and at a local level. To be divided, you have to want to be divided. You have to be part of that. And I don't, there is a lot of friction and there is a lot of tension, but I think nonetheless, we did all get back together on Pesach, the Seder night, and as David was saying, you know, families that are very different managed to sit down together on Pesach, and they managed to sit down together on Friday nights. And I think that will go on. That is part of us, and that doesn't matter who's at the top of the country.
Steve, last Yom Ha'atzmaut, we were all stuck at home, right, because of the seger, the lockdown. We did a barbecue on our balcony. I'm sure almost all of you pretty much did the same thing in your backyards at home or whatever. Looking in that span of a year, right, it has changed us.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that changed this year, for example, is I keep on getting messages, invitations inviting me to Yom Ha'atzmaut barbecues.
Well, that's because you're a popular guy.
Last year, you know, we were sort of all alone or with our nuclear families. And I think that really you do have to credit Netanyahu and this government for the vaccination campaign that managed to, inoculate a huge amount of people. Not enough, but it seems like we're returning to some kind of new normal anyway, if not starting a whole new way of life. And then people are still wearing masks, although there's talk about removing them, but I think we're feeling a whole lot more confident. At the same time, though, you know, there have been a lot of problems with the way Netanyahu and his government handled the crisis, and we obviously had too many deaths. We should have closed the airports earlier, etc. cetera. But I think that if you look at the big picture, and again, I try not to be too cynical. I'm optimistic that we're starting a new era here. It may be a post-Netanyahu era, and I do think it's time for Netanyahu to step down. But I think, you know, credit needs to be given where it's due, and that we're all vaccinated, most of us, in large part due to this government. And now it's time to perhaps move into a new future where we, instead of polarization into two different camps and left and right, we need to find a way to stand together this Yom HaAtzmaut, as a people, as a country, also as, you know, Jews, Muslims, Christians, and different kinds of Jews all standing together. It's crazy that we've been split. This policy of divide and conquer is certainly not working, at least for me. And I think it's time that we all stood together as Israelis and celebrated 73 years of independence together, rather than looking at each other and blaming each other and have what we call in Hebrew sinat chinam, unbaseless hatred. This is a time for love and healing.
Is this the worst it's been? That was beautifully said, Steve. But is this the worst it's been as you can recall?
No, I actually think it's getting better and better. You know, so for me, I'd much rather have made Aliyah to Israel today than when I did 33 years ago, when we didn't have all those fancy products that we can get now. But it's much better today than it was then, and it's getting better all the time.
I think the divisions have changed also because for those of us who went through the first Lebanon War, I mean, that was a terribly divisive period. And I think also socially within the Jewish community, there were much, much greater divide between Ashkenazi and Sephardi. And now it's almost a joke, you know, the sitcoms play on it and so on. But everybody knows families that possibly everybody has family that's already mixed. But everybody knows family. Yeah, I mean, everybody knows a family that's mixed Sephardi Ashkenazi. It's that divide is almost a thing of the past, outside of the Haredi world. So I don't think you can say that we're more divided than ever. In many ways, I think we've been able to come together and to argue together. I mean, that's the pastime, is arguing.
Roselle, I just want to ask you, and maybe we'll finish on this note. You recently wrote a story about new scrolls, right, that were discovered near the Dead Sea. Can you just tell us quickly what that was?
So they, for the first time in some 50 years, they discovered new scrolls in a cave near the Dead Sea. And what is very exciting, that is a biblical scroll, and it actually offered a new version of one of the books of prophet that had never been recorded on previous scrolls.
So how old were they?
Some 2,000 years old.
2,000 years old.
Yes.
Right. So to me, at the end of the day, when I think about everything we've just spoken about, and then you see that they discovered a scroll that's 2,000 years old, it puts things into proportion, right? We're a speck of dust in the timeline of the Jewish people who have lived here in the land of Israel. We have to do, as Steve said, I think, a better job, and as Liat and David and Rosella trying to come together. But we do have a contextual kind of timeline of where we fall on that. And to remember that we're here to preserve something that's far greater. The people in the caves who once wrote scrolls thousands of years. Today with the Jerusalem Post, we read a scroll every day, but then it just, you know, wraps fish the next day.
We have that phrase, Avonu et Paro Navo Gam et Zeh. We survived Pharaoh, we'll get through this also. And I think that really is a part of who we are. It's like, we'll get through it. Somehow we'll get through it. We have that resilience.
Okay. Well, on that note, happy Independence Day, everyone. Thank you. Yona, great to have you with us. So you've been going to court a lot lately. It's something I guess you used to do. You were a lawyer once upon a time, and now you've been covering legal affairs, among other things, intelligence, Mossad, espionage for the Jerusalem Post. But you've been going there a lot for the last 2 weeks, pretty much because of Netanyahu's trial. And we've been hearing every day, I have to say, it's like an earth-shattering headline coming from Ilan Yoshua, the former CEO of Walla. If we didn't have explosions in places like Natanz and deadlock in our politics and Yom HaZikaron and Independence Day, these would be making front page headlines. But give us kind of just the synopsis. What has Ilan Yoshua been telling after so many days of testimony, and why is it important for the prosecution?
Right. So there's two very important components here. One is setting the table. All right, Ilan Yoshua, in a lot of ways, started the story of Case 4000, the Bezek-Walla affair. Just a quick review, the Bezek-Walla affair is basically you have Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu asking the owner of both Bezek and Walla to give him positive coverage in Walla.
Not Walla just, being a news site, Walla, Bezek being a big telecom company.
The second largest Hebrew media internet news site at the time in Israel, so very powerful, very influential. And Bezek, right, the telecommunications giant. And so positive coverage from Walla, not just that, but also negative coverage of his competitors, which is a key point to all of this. So coverage across the board, whatever he wants, basically, from Walla. And in exchange, Netanyahu, who at the time was communications minister, will make sure that all sorts of policies that Shaul Elovich, who owned Bezek and Walla, that he wanted for Bezek would go through, including the merger between Bezek and Yes, including reducing reforms that the Likud's Gilad Erdan, who had been communications minister before Netanyahu, had wanted to push through, reforms that were supported by the rank and file professional experts. So basically put all of those, slow them down, reduce them, everything basically that Shaul Elovich wanted. We've seen numbers like that this benefited Shaul Elovich up to 1 billion shekels in terms of value, and nobody can really estimate the value of, you know, such positive coverage for yourself and negative coverage against your competitors when you have two elections coming up in 2013 and 2015 when all of this was going on.
Now, correct me, right, but Ilan Yoshua is key because he's the guy, is the CEO who the Aloviches allegedly were texting, were giving instructions to, because they were hearing from Netanyahu what they need to do on the website. They obviously couldn't do it, so they would, because they're not actively operating the site, they would pass it on to Ilan, who would then have to find some way to make the website comply with all of this. And in some of those text messages, I mean, give us some of the kind of the juicy messages that Ilan Yoshua claims he received.
Right. So you have the message that they put, you know, on the screen, basically, where Elovich says to Ilan Yeshua, I'm going to kill you. And the context of this, I don't think anybody really thinks that he was necessarily going to kill him, but it's showing how important it was for Elovich to fulfill Netanyahu's wishes on a particular story item. We have, you know, examples where Yeshua is firing or making the life of miserable for some of his own editors who he loves, and he feels terrible about it, and he's testifying in court how terrible he felt that he did it, but he felt like he had to do it. Why did he have to do it? He loved the job. He liked the money. He thought it would end soon because Shaul Elovich always telling him we only have to do it for a couple more months and then Bezek will be taken care of by Netanyahu. Then we can go back to normal. And it's amazing looking at Yoshua, you know, up front, and you can see the man is actually tortured by this, and I think that will give a lot of authenticity to his testimony. It's not like he's saying, I was a good guy. He's saying, I was part of it. I mean, at the same time,
although he's not a suspect and he's not a state's witness.
That's exactly what he was going to say, yes, which is why he's such a killer witness, is number one, he's not trying to make himself look good, and number two, he's not getting immunity out of this.
He didn't commit any alleged crime, did he?
So that's a great question. The defense lawyers for Netanyahu and Elovich think that he did commit a crime and want to know the opinion, internal opinion of the prosecution, why they didn't charge him. I think you could argue that he might have committed a crime. There are reasons, if you want to get into it, I could explain why he might be different. But the point is, that makes him a stronger witness, because some people say that if somebody was given immunity, well, maybe they're just telling the judges what the prosecution want to tell them. Here, Yoshua, because he wasn't charged, they can't attack him for that. Now, the one thing I have to say, given that he's setting the table, is he's not the killer witness against Netanyahu. He's the killer witness.
Okay, so that's exactly what I wanted to get to. So he's giving us only one side of the story, which is I received instructions from my owner, my boss, Shaul Elovich, to make changes to the website that I oversaw. But there's a whole other side to this story, and that's the Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu, for example, received an exemption from participating or from having to attend the testimony of Ilan Yoshua by saying, it had nothing to do with me, right? And the court allowed him so far not to have to come to listen in on those testimonies. He came just for the opening statement of the prosecution. So what is the other side of this? How do you put two and two together to actually get to the bribery charge against Netanyahu?
So first of all, Yeshua is nailing Elovitch, and if there's a bribe giver, then there's a bribe receiver, usually. It makes it hard to convict Elovitch and not to say that Netanyahu was part of, you know, who was Elovitch doing it with, himself? And secondly, there's a lot of pieces where it seems like Yeshua is getting pretty close to Netanyahu. I mean, the key witnesses against Netanyahu are going to be Shlomo Filber and Nir Chefetz, who are Netanyahu's aides, who have pointed the finger at him and said they were in the room with him.
Shlomo Filber, sorry to interrupt, being the Director General of the Communications Ministry at the time, so getting instructions from Netanyahu, Nir Chefetz being his spokesperson.
Right.
And getting, and he was also apparently, right, the go-to guy between the Prime Minister and the Aloviches.
Right. There were a few, but he was one of the biggest go-to guys, you know, messengers. Netanyahu had a lot of messengers.
Everybody needs a go-to guy.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So Nir Chefetz was their go-to
guy. And really, the lesson of this...
You need a guy.
You need a guy, but the lesson of this case and the Olmert case is you have to take care of your guy, because if you don't take care of your guy, then he turns state witness on you.
So if you're going to do crimes, if you're going to commit a crime, make sure your guy is happy.
Yes, absolutely. Right.
So that's a good lesson for life in general. Okay, so just getting back to the trial. So so Ilan Yeshua, he'll be testifying for a couple more weeks at least, right? Then the defense attorneys get to counter-question him.
Cross-examine, yeah.
Cross-examine. Thank you. And then what happens? Then the prosecution brings more witnesses?
Right. Then there's going to be a bunch of other witnesses from Walla, other senior editors that will basically confirm and add pieces to the story so you can see, connect the dots. Because Yeshua himself wasn't changing the articles. Yeshua is still high up. He's the CEO. A lot of CEOs don't necessarily usually have anything to do with the news side. So these are going to be the editors who actually ordered the changes, maybe even made the actual changes on the website, or ordered the reporters to write a story this way, write a story that way, where the instructions were coming down from Yeshua, who at least knew something about news.
I have to say, I mean, you know, as the editor of a newspaper, this is complicated stuff, right? You know, it's, I think it's, for anyone who works in the media business, it's, we deal with these kind of issues often. I mean, again, not being told by owners to change stories to appease a politician, but there's constant pressures on all businesses, and, you know, journalist businesses are not that much different than any other business out there. I think that might be one of the arguments, right, that Netanyahu is going to be making.
Absolutely. It's a fair statement. One of their best quotes is they say, you know, 2.5, you know, positive articles for Netanyahu. And if it was only 2.5 positive articles, there would be no case. I don't think there would have been an indictment. If there were only 5 positive articles, I don't think
there
would...
But you've written that there are
315 separate incidents. Netanyahu, according to the prosecution himself, can only be specifically tied to 150 of them.
Only.
But, right. But the other ones were all close aides of his who are going to say that he told them, you know, to do it, or they were under general instructions to do it. And the other thing that I think is key that's different here is, you know, speaking from my perspective, my personal experience in the industry and other, you know, colleagues of mine, when we give, you know, access... Or when we get access for a good story, it's usually one good story for one good access. Maybe two good stories for one good access. We never, or I don't know anything about somebody doing negative stories about other people because you got access. That's just not something that's done.
I guess it's a different type of quid pro quo, right? But let me ask you, you know, one of the things that comes up, and you mentioned those numbers, which are, if you pause and think about this for a moment. So 315 different incidents, 100 and how many that the prosecution
around 150, according to the prosecution,
that they can directly connect to Prime Minister Netanyahu. So this is a guy who's running a country, right? I mean, we just look at the last year, COVID-19, fighting Iran, getting vaccines. I mean, there's never a dull moment in Israel, right? So it wasn't COVID. It was the Palestinian terrorism, peace process, pressure from the Obama administration, whatever it might have been. And he finds the time to focus on 150 different news articles, whether they're to make them positive about him, to make them negative about his rivals, right? Naftali Bennett was one of those people he was targeting.
Naftali Bennett, Naftali Bennett's wife, Naftali Bennett's father.
So maybe I hang up with Naftali Bennett. That's interesting. I mean, that's a lot of broadband, or, like, you know, space in your mind to say, even though I'm the Prime Minister, I'm super, super busy. I got to focus on this website and these headlines.
And follow up. I mean, what we heard today was something like 2 days of constant messages about a particular story related to Uri Ariel, who everybody in the Knesset is important, but he's not exactly a powerhouse.
I doubt there's maybe a handful of listeners right now who know who Uri Ariel is, so just remind us.
Uri Ariel was a top official in the Beit Yehudi Religious Zionist Party, but he wasn't the leader of the Religious Zionist Party, and the Religious Zionist Party at the time was not one of the two or three largest parties. So the idea that the prime minister, if it's all true, was spending, you know, himself and multiple aides 2 days trying to get a negative story about Uri Ariel over something having to do with house demolitions, so that maybe, you know, there wouldn't be a tiny bit of momentum from people on his right to take away from him as being Mr. Security. It says, again, if it's true, he's spending an awful lot of time on it.
Well, I mean, it might also say something that maybe we don't fully appreciate the weight of what we do every day, right? Which I wonder, you know, if he's so focused on those articles, and like you said, spending 2 days to make sure to tailor some sort of negative article about Uri Ariel or about Naftali Bennett's wife, or make sure that there's a positive article about him, shows just how influential he sees the media being for his electorate, right, and influencing public opinion. Now, we all know, right, you and I working in this business, we know that obviously the way we frame a story, the way we write a headline, the way we tell a story is going to influence public opinion. But you see here how much that impacts a prime minister and how much time he will devote to something like this.
And I guess you could say, from that perspective, being that he's been prime minister since 2009 and is the longest running prime minister in the history, maybe he knew something, you know, so maybe he does know how to work the media, and maybe his only sin here was he went a little bit too far, but maybe the fact that he has followed the media so carefully has helped keep him in power for a long time. And I guess you're right. Maybe we have even more influence than we realize.
I'll tell you a quick story. In 2017, I was in the United States on a short vacation, and I was sitting at a home of a friend who lives in a secluded, gated island near Miami with a home overlooking the Biscayne Bay. Beautiful. It was a sunny morning. I'm sitting on his balcony drinking espresso, and I get a text message from a senior official in the prime minister's office who I know sat at the time, no longer works there, 3 doors down from the prime minister, very close to him, and says to me, Yaakov, can I call you? I said, sure. Calls me, doesn't know where I am. Opens the conversation, do you read every word in the newspaper? So I get that question every once in a while, and it's usually because there's a complaint coming, and I said, what's the issue? And he went on to tell me how there was a letter to the editor that day that was critical of why the prime minister was taking his wife Sarah with him on trips overseas. And why should the taxpayer have to pick up the bill and foot the bill for that? So I said to the person 3 different things. I said, number one, I'm on vacation right now in Miami overlooking the Biscayne Bay. So whoever is telling you that there's someone out to get Sarah Netanyahu by placing this letter to the editor in the Jerusalem Post, please calm them down. Number two, I said, it's a letter to the editor. It's not our editorial. It's not an opinion piece by some columnist. It's not an article written by a journalist of ours. It's a letter to the editor. And I have respect for our right readers, but that's a letter to the editor. And I said, three, now that you make me think about it, I actually think if it's good for the prime minister that he should have his wife with him, make some calm, relax before he goes into important meetings with world leaders, we should foot the bill. I mean, you know, I don't see a problem with that. And we went on to actually write an editorial because I actually said, now that you raised the issue and it was in the headlines at the time, we're actually, I think it's a good idea. Let's write in favor of it. But it goes to show how even a letter to the editor is jarring for them to an extent, right? And how it's something that would make them place a call to an editor.
Right. I can say that when I get criticism regarding an article that I write, I think if you're going to be in journalism, you have to have thick skin. But there are times that, especially if like another journalist goes after you, especially if somebody, you know, spreads it around, it's not that easy. So, you know, some of it could be politics, you know, good politics is you want to have more positive stories, less negative stories. And some of it is we're all, even politicians are human beings. And maybe sometimes, you know, bad stories for them just, you know, hit them where it hurts.
So, Yona, just very quickly, the trial's continuing. But to anyone who thinks this is over soon, not at all.
Not even close. The earliest estimates before we started were 1 year. And having been in there now for about 2 weeks, I'd say there's no chance that will only take 1 year. There would have to be radical change in the defense approach. The defense approach seems to be object anytime they think that they can, whether it's on principle, which they do have a number of principles that they can go after, such as Ilan Yoshua producing new statements that he didn't make to the police. That's something you have the right to object about. But the volume of objections seems to suggest that there is also a concerted overall strategy to draw this out as long as possible. It could be to keep the defendants, you know, out of jail in case they lose. It could be because there's all sorts of dynamic politics and somebody might be wanting to cut a plea bargain depending on, you know, what's going on at a later date.
Or waiting for a new president to take over who could then pardon him.
A new president to take over, a new attorney general to take over in February 2022. So yeah, this trial, I would say if the initial estimates were short version would be a year, I'd say short version would be a year and a half. And there were always estimates that it could go as long as 3 years. I found that a little bit hard to believe at the beginning, and now I don't.
That's very optimistic. Thank you. Thank you for that, Yona. So the Netanyahu trial is here to stick with us for a long time. People, buckle up. And Yona, thanks for going to court, and we'll continue to hear from you and to read what is being said in the Netanyahu bribery, fraud, and breach of trust trial. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thanks for being with us. See you next week.